Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
President Obama and the Middle East. Hello again, I'm Omar Nalini, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. As the Muslim world waits for tomorrow's message, President Obama met with Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah today. What can they do for each other about Iran, the Taliban, and peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians? Also on Which Way LA, budget cuts and teacher layoffs are leading to hunger strikes and camp-ins at LA Unified Schools. Parents have new powers to make tough decisions, but no training for a difficult and sensitive job. What's happening at charter schools? First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. State Controller John Chung says the governor is not kidding about the need for billions in budget cuts in the next 2 weeks. We'll hear how students, parents, and teachers are trying to cope with a changing educational environment. On Reporter's Notebook, can the Lakers stop Dwight Howard? That's at 7:30 tonight. First, this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. As President Obama arrived in Saudi Arabia today, Al Jazeera aired what purports to be a threatening new audio tape from Osama bin Laden. But King Abdullah met Air Force One in searing heat at the airport, and the two exchanged kisses on both cheeks. Scott Wilson is traveling with the president for The Washington Post. And Scott, thanks for being on our program.
Thank you.
Is that about as much publicly as we're expected to get from President Obama as he visits Saudi Arabia, or do you think there will be more public statements to come?
No, I think that they're done for the night. They're out at the Royal Ranch outside of Riyadh, where I am, and I don't think we'll be hearing anything more from them. They met for several hours this afternoon, just the two of them. And we're waiting to hear a little bit more about what they talked about. We imagine it involved the Israeli-Palestinian issue and the Iranian nuclear program. Some of the Obama's senior aides have confirmed that.
What about the price of oil?
Price of oil was probably on the agenda, although it's not something that his advisors who knew what they were going to be speaking about could confirm actually came up. But I'm sure it'll be mentioned.
What is the president looking for, and why this particular visit at this moment? It was scheduled late in the day, just last week.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think part of it is to try to build some momentum around Israeli-Palestinian, a would-be peace process there. He's taking more of an outside-in approach to that and asking Arab countries to perhaps do a little bit more to give some incentives to Israel to begin talks with the Palestinians. That might include a slightly revised Arab peace initiative that would remove the so-called right of return for Palestinians to return to homes inside Israel and other normalization steps. The Saudis are pretty cool to that idea. They feel like they've done plenty, and it's Israel's turn to step up. That's one thing. The other is to touch on Iran, most likely the nuclear program. It's an area where the Israelis and the Americans and the Saudis really see their interests coinciding. No one particularly wants Iran to get a nuclear weapon if that is what they're pursuing. So that's another. And also what the president mentioned at the top of your show, this is a place where Islam began, and he's about to give a big speech tomorrow in Cairo, an outreach to the Muslim world.
Before we go further with what's happening in with regard to Saudi Arabia, what are the president's objectives in delivering this speech tomorrow?
Well, we've heard quite a bit about it and just got a fairly detailed briefing. The objective it sounds to me like it's going to be a kind of a deep exploration of what went wrong in U.S. relations with the Islamic world from both sides. So the president's impression of where the U.S. has fallen down and certainly Islamic extremism on the other side and where that comes from. Under that broad sort of message, there'll be specific policies that he'll address. He will talk about Palestine and what to be his sense of the conflict is how his administration officials have described it, and he will also talk about the role that Muslims play in the United States, a role he sees as very important. He'll also draw on his own history. His father, of course, was Muslim. So his objective really is to dispel some misperceptions and to address head-on, his advisors say, some of the of the policies that really have caused the most tension over the years on both sides.
But back to the visit to Saudi Arabia, you said the president probably won't have anything further to say there, and I assume that's true of King Abdullah as well. He's not going to give the president a send-off, making any concessions or announcing any sorts of agreements.
I don't think so. We're on a strange clock here. We actually ship out here at 2 a.m. Saudi time. The president leaves not that long after, before dawn. So I think that's the last we'll see of either of them. King Abdullah hosted President Bush out there last year. And they watched Arabian horses and a falconry exhibition. And so who knows what they're up to, but they might be having some fun.
Have they had anything to say about the release, the purported release of this statement, rather threatening statement, saying there will be consequences for the United States because of what's been happening in Pakistan, that coming allegedly from Osama bin Laden?
Yeah, the administration's view on that, and we just heard from the press secretary, Robert Gibbs, on the subject, is this is a way for bin Laden to insert himself in what the administration hopes is a sort of a positive story. From this president reaching out and explaining the United States to the Muslim world and trying to steal some limelight, so to speak. Gibbs said this is not a particularly interesting statement. We've heard this sort of thing before, and the timing is such to sort of steal a little bit of the president's thunder.
All right. Scott Wilson, again, White House reporter for The Washington Post, with the president or the president's party in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Khaled Al-Maina is editor-in-chief of Arab News. That's an English-language newspaper based in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. It's distributed throughout the Middle East. And Khaled Al-Maina, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Is this, as the White House hopes, and as Scott Wilson just phrased it, a largely positive story so far?
So far, it's a positive story, but we hope that Mr. Obama will be able to deliver, because people are here in this part of the world are fed up with talk. Obama has promised a lot of things during the election campaign, to have peace in the Middle East, to have an outreach to the Muslim world, to deal with them on an equal basis, and people are looking up to it and also waiting impatiently for tomorrow's speech at the Cairo University Auditorium.
What do they expect? When you say you hope he can deliver, what is he supposed to deliver?
Well, number one, I think, is no president since Eisenhower has been able to say no to the Israelis. What he could deliver at the moment, at least on a limited basis, is stop Israeli expansion and settlements in the occupied West Bank and let the people of Gaza not be starved. I think if he does that, I think he'll gain a lot of, you know, popularity in terms of political popularity here, and people will start believing him, because people are, as I said before, fed up, they're tired, they've been hearing a lot of things. People want peace, and they do hope that the King Abdullah plan of 2002 will be accelerated by the presence of Mr. Obama in the region, and who will then try to tell the Israelis that it's high time now that both sides get together and formulate some kind of treaty with equal guarantee and security for both a Palestinian state, a viable Palestinian state, not a truncated one, and Israel.
We just heard Scott Wilson mention that Arab peace plan of 2002, saying that it was the hope, perhaps, of the United States that something be removed from it, namely that the guarantees of a right of return for Palestinians who left Israel after the Israelis themselves took over. It was suggested that might be an incentive for the Israelis to respond in kind. Is there any likelihood, do you think, that the Arab countries would give up that that provision about the right of return?
Well, the Arab countries have no right to give up. It's the right of the Palestinians, especially those in 1967 who had to flee because of the war. I think it's their right to go back. And it's high time that Israel realizes this, that over the last 42 years, and we are in that month of June, when so many thousands of people came and settled in Israel at the expense of the natives, I think Palestinians would not agree to that. At least a token right of return would go a long way to alleviate all what's happening.
Again, Khaled Al-Maina is editor-in-chief of Arab News, English-language paper published in Saudi Arabia. Let's hear a bit of what President Obama himself has said about his relations with Israel, particularly on the issue of settlements.
In my conversations with Prime Minister Netanyahu, I was very clear about the need to stop settlements, to make sure that we are stopping the building of outposts, to work with the Palestinian Authority in order to alleviate some of the pressures that the Palestinian people are under.
Again, back to Khaled Al-Maina, what more can the president say than that? I don't know what's happening here. Khaled Al-Maina, are you still with us? Well, we seem to have some interference on the phone. We'll get back to Mr. Al-Maina in a moment. Let me first introduce Waleed Fariz, who is a senior fellow, director of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a conservative organization, author most recently of The War of Ideas, Jihadism Against Democracies, also teaches global strategies at the National Defense University in Washington, D.C. Waleed Fariz, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think about the issue of settlements and what the president has said so far, what he's likely to say tomorrow?
Way before we get to the issue of settlement, which is a very punctual matter, we have to relook at the whole project of President Obama going to Cairo, to the Azhar University, delivering a speech to the Muslim world. That's a very, very big block of people. It's 52 Muslim countries, including 21 Arab states, with as many problems within all these countries, including, of course, the Arab-Israeli conflict on the top, but then you have the Iraq situation, the Afghanistan situation, human rights, and on top of all of those, there is the big Darfur situation. He's going to be about 1,000 miles north of Darfur, the first African-American president, and I am very curious to know if he is going to at least touch upon that issue, which means to me that, on the one hand, all what has been discussed about improvement he is going to be trying to make with regard to Israelis and Palestinians, putting pressure on the Israelis to stop the settlements, putting pressure on the Palestinians to unite and have the Arab world with them, that is already digested. That is in the works. What is not known is the fact that he's going to open the scope to include in his speech or in his approach the support to the underdogs of the region. And chief issue is going to be Darfur. Will he mention it or not? Is he going to mention the issue not of spreading democracy but supporting democratic elements while he is going to be meeting with monarchs and presidents? Is he going to be talking about contentious issues, important issues, but still in the Muslim world, such as what to do with Iran, with Syria, and of course the whole Taliban matter in the Middle East, in the Far East? So to me, the fact that we framed the issue, a speech to the Muslim world, need a lot of reflection, because that's a big difference between a speech to the Arab-Israeli conflict, a speech to the Levant, a speech to the narrow Middle East.
So the you're suggesting the Muslim world is not just limited to the situation between Israel and the Palestinians, but isn't that one of the major bones of contention between Muslims and the United States?
That's how it was framed by the various ideological forces in the region. You ask the Kurds in northern Iraq, what is your top issue? You ask the Shia, for example, in eastern Arabia. You ask the Arab minority in Iran. And as I said, you ask the Darfur population. You ask the Lebanese, who are going to a very important, crucial election on Sunday. There will be many intellectuals, many journalists, many anchors who will tell you, well, if you solve the Arab-Israeli conflict by putting pressure here and there, then everything else will be fine. That is not true. And if President Obama wants to have a real change of direction, he is going to have to be balanced, meaning he will put as much pressure as needed on Israelis and Palestinians, but he cannot, as the other side wants, meaning those who only want to see the Arab-Israeli issue, if I may say, regimes or organizations, because they don't want to see other issues addressed. Now, you're going to see a collection of Arab governments and spokespersons saying that as long as the Palestinian issue and the Gaza issue is not addressed, nothing else can be addressed. I disagree with that, because human rights, oppression and suppression of civil societies, and other very important issues in the region have to be addressed at the same time. I hope that President Obama will have a real change from previous classical policies of the previous and the previous administrations after the end of the Cold War.
Walid Faris, again at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Back to Khaled Al-Maina, the editor-in-chief of Arab News. Were you saying that the Israeli-Palestinian issue must be number one solved, and the resolution of it would resolve all of these other issues?
Well, it will not resolve other issues, as was mentioned by the gentleman before me, Darfur, human rights, women's enhancements and all. But it would go a long way to ease tension in the region, that's for sure. But there are other basic issues that have to be looked into, the development of a civil society across the Arab world, other issues, other expectations, the induction of young people in the workforce, and there's so on and so forth. But I do stress that settlement of the Arab-Israel issue would really go a long way. Number one, also it will not allow anyone to come in and do collective harm. Everybody who did harm, like Saddam and others, took the issue of Israel, and on the basis of that, they even killed their own people. So I would say that this issue may not be the prime issue, but it is a very important issue.
Walid Faris is still with us, director of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. What about this statement today from Osama bin Laden? It was said earlier that the White House feels that it's just him trying to assert himself in what is so far a very positive story in the Middle East. I'm interested in your take on it.
I agree with the White House estimate on Al-Qaeda. Actually, since the election of President Obama, since he entered the White House, we've seen a pattern from Al-Qaeda and their allies. They are frustrated with the fact that he is an African-American, that his father is Muslim, that he want to have a change in the U.S. Muslim relationship, and most of all, that there is a large segment of the youth in the Middle East, for any reason, that is very interested in this new leadership. So you can see every time Obama moves, either internationally or in the Arab and Muslim world, you kind of now predict that there will be a speech by, or a statement, or a video by one of the top two of Al-Qaeda attacking him. This is frustration.
And in fact, we heard from the number two yesterday as well. So frustration, but not a real threat, is what you're saying.
I don't think that if there is a real threat conspiracy against the president that they would issue a press release before. This is a sort of a call to their constituencies not to be attracted by this phenomenon. I mean, it is that dramatic for them by accusing him of everything, of he is the same as George Bush but with different style. But at the end of the day, their constituencies are ideological. It's the new recruits that they are concerned about, not to get enough new recruits as people so far are attracted to the Obama message. But that may change in the future when President Obama will make his speech. And, of course, in any political speech, it's going to have those who are going to be supportive and those who are going to be less supportive. And this is where Al-Qaeda is going to try to come back and recruit.
I know you need to leave us, so thanks so much for the time you've given us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Walid Faris, Senior Fellow and Director of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Quickly back to Khaled Al-Maina, Editor-in-Chief of the Arab News. Is this speech by President Obama really going to be listened to by people on the street in the Arab world, the young people who might be recruits, for example, to Al-Qaeda?
Well, first of all, let me say that everyone will listen. From Morocco to Indonesia, people are going to listen. I have friends in Malaysia who called me, and they are sort of getting ready to sit and listen. Indonesia, Philippines, the Muslims there. I don't think so. It's recruiting for the Al-Qaeda is as easy as joining the Marines or joining an army anywhere. The Al-Qaeda has lost its glamour. I mean, it never had any glamour except in certain parts of the American Western media. People here scoff, and especially after they went on killing sprees. Of course, there are disgruntled people, and there were people who had grievances. But Mr. Obama is seen as one of us. He's seen as a person who came from a background, and he proved what was an American dream that anyone with true grit and determination and the will and the power can really get on. So Obama is a folklore hero even in this part of the world. So people wish him well. They do not wish Al-Qaeda or any other evil organization to harm him or something. So, but as I said, Obama's speech should be followed with action. I mean, they would applaud the speech, they will talk about it, they will analyze it. But at a later stage, I think they will wait for the person to come and deliver the goods.
Again, Harla Dalmaina, the editor-in-chief of the Arab News. Steve Clemens is director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. He's also publisher of the political blog, The Washington Note. And Steve Clemens, good to have you back on our program.
Great to be with you, Warren.
Let's look at another issue that has been mentioned but not discussed in detail as yet, and that is Iran. What do you think is the president's objective? Does the United States share objectives not only with Israel in this regard, but also Saudi Arabia?
Well, Saudi Arabia for quite a long time has been in quietly encouraging both President Bush and now President Obama to engage Iran, but not to give away the store to Iran. The Saudis and really the whole the Gulf region is very worried about Iran's nuclear pretensions and its broader meddling inside other governments in the region. And they worry that a deal could be done with Iran that forfeits their interests. At the same time, they don't endorse a kind of hot military action against Iran. And so they want to see engagement. They want to see it shrewd and tough-minded. And frankly, they want to be built in to what Obama's planning to do. They don't have a very good sense yet. And it's what I think the real core of the Obama King Abdullah talk is going to be, is how does Obama really see the pieces that move together? How do they fit together? What are they going to be the things that President Obama believes will show progress that the Saudis can believe in? Because they've been down this road with President Bush before, where President Bush convinced them that he was going to be serious both about Iran, but also about the Arab peace initiative. And frankly, while the king kind of believed President Bush, the rest of the Bush administration didn't come along, and it just never happened. And I think they're very frustrated with the lack of at least transparency at that elite level, and the fact that they worry about Iran's pretensions in the region and the United States might give away too much.
What particularly were they looking for, the Saudis, not only in terms of Iran, but in terms of the situation with Israel that the Bush administration or President Bush promised but failed to deliver?
Well, first on the peace process, you know, when the King Abdullah he was crown prince then, put the Arab Peace Initiative on the table in 2002 in Beirut, it was revived again in 2005, only under the conditions that President Bush would really, really push the Arab Peace Initiative. And according to the Saudis, President Bush gave his personal ironclad commitment to see this thing through and to knock back some of the neoconservative influences that had been dominating his administration. And the Saudis saw that, you know, sort of come to nothing. So I think that with from Obama, they want to hear something more than, you know, discussion of settlements and right to return and, you know, the building up of another grand epic that fails. They want to see something that shows maturity and reality. And frankly, the Saudis really put their neck out twice. Once on putting the Arab Peace Initiative out there to begin with, because it's a normalization plan for 22 other countries with Israel, and to some degree it puts the leadership at odds with their own street, if you will. And if it just languishes out there, it makes the Saudi leaders look weak and look like flax for a process that's going nowhere, just to pay homage to Israel and American relations. So that's one thing. On Iran, I think that the issues are complex. They want Iran to be contained. They want the meddling inside other states by Shia groups to be rolled back. They want America not to acquiesce to what is going to be, by any other name, a weapons program there. They don't want to see a nuclear breakout in the region. And there are many other parts of this, but at the same time, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, who for 20 years headed Saudi intelligence and was the former ambassador of Saudi Arabia to the United States, has said there is no military solution to the problem in Iran. It must be engaged, and you must acknowledge to some degree its growing influence in the region, but it will not be the influence in the region. The Saudis see Iran as its chief political rivals throughout the Middle East. And to some degree, Iran and Saudi Arabia have been competing with each other over which of them is the true defender of the Islamic faith. And I think that's at the core. And if we don't begin to get some of these things right, what I think may happen is a kind of proxy war, if you will, between Iranian and Saudi interests throughout the Middle East. Not a direct war between them, but rather a skirmish everywhere else in the region, and that could be very, very damaging for everyone's interests.
Can the President of the United States, even though he's African-American and has the middle name that he does, get involved in an argument between Iran and Saudi Arabia over who is the true defender of the Muslim faith? That's kind of out of bounds, isn't it?
Well, to some degree it is, and he's not going to do that. I mean, I think that's between them about what's going to happen. What both sides want to see, I think, you know, everybody in the region is, gravitational forces, without casting blame on any administration, have been taking the Middle East into a darker and darker place where it looks like there is significant doubt about America's ability to achieve the objectives it sets out for itself. And to some degree, the Iranians feel this weakness. The Saudis sense this weakness and inability. The Israelis have been pushing their interests. And to some degree, what everyone wants to see is, can this mesmerizing president, who has a lot of sizzle, come in and suggest sort of Nixon goes to China possibilities of reframing the way the Middle East looks itself and get to the interconnectedness of these things. One of the things that really is appealing to the Saudis and a lot of other Middle East observers is how Barack Obama is not allowing one problem to be siloed off from another. And he's talking about the broad region and all of its interconnected pieces. He's going to Egypt. He's jumping to Saudi Arabia. He's talking about Israel, Palestine, and Syria. He's seeing the relevance of all of these to Iraq and Pakistan and Afghanistan. This was not the way that the Bush administration operated. And to some degree, that's heartening to the people there that they see someone who is a serious strategist, or at least the possibility of a serious strategist. That can move things forward, and then they can have their own, you know, struggles over which, you know, the custodian of the two holy mosques or some, you know, Iran that wants to reach out to the Arab Muslim world, that can play out. But at least in geostrategic and geopolitical stability, other goals can be accomplished, and the United States can return to a position of seeming like it has leverage and influence in the region, which almost all the players in the region want, maybe except Iran. But to some degree, all the other players want to see that.
All right. We will talk tomorrow about the speech to the Muslim world. It will have been delivered by the time we are on the air again, presumably. In the meantime, thank you all very much for helping us get ready for it in a way and see it in this broader context, and also talk very specifically about Saudi Arabia and its importance both to the Obama administration and the rest of the world. Steve Clemens at the New America Foundation, Khaled Al-Maina with the Arab News, thank you very much for having been with us today, Waleed Faris at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, and Scott Wilson traveling with the president for the Washington Post. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. In a moment, teachers and parents cope with drastic cutbacks at LA schools as the Lakers prepare to cope with the magic on Which Way LA. Norman Olney back with Which Way LA. The state Senate's about to hold hearings on restructuring government to make it more efficient. In the meantime, service providers and school administrators are transforming their operations, to use Governor Schwarzenegger's phrase. That means cutting so deeply that core missions are being compromised. Julie Van Winkle is a teacher and a union representative at the John Lathy Middle School, which opened just 2 years ago in the Pico Union area west of downtown L.A. 70% of the teachers have pink slips. Julie Van Winkle, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Your school, as I understand it, was off to a good start with a young teaching staff, people dedicated to being in a middle school in the inner city. What's going to happen now?
Well, like you said, it's actually a little bit over 70% of us who are going to be losing our jobs. And the problem is we don't know what's going to happen in terms of the school. We know that we're not going to have jobs after June 30th, but more importantly, all the progress that we've made over these 2 years, all the programs we've developed at our school, they're in jeopardy because we don't know who is going to come and take these positions. It's going to be teachers who are pushed out of their elementary schools mostly because in the elementary schools we see the biggest class size increase. It's going from 20 students in a classroom up to 24 in kindergarten through third grade. So that means that the elementary schools are going to require fewer teachers. So the teachers who have the lowest seniority at the elementary school are going to be asked to take our jobs at the middle school.
So now, is it different teaching in a middle school and in the inner city than it is in the elementary schools where they've been?
Oh, yes. And I mean, you know, a lot of the elementary school teachers are also going to be coming from the inner city. But in elementary, generally, especially in the primary grades, you have one teacher to one class of students the whole day, and then that teacher teaches all the different subjects. In middle school, the way we do it at Lacey is we try to have each teacher teaches either math or science or English and social studies, but they teach it to two different groups of students. So it's a big difference, and it's a big shift because the elementary teachers are used to having, you know, lower class sizes and just one class, you know, 20 to 30 students depending on the grade level in elementary. And then, you know, in middle school you see 75 students a day because you're dealing with different classes.
Tell us about the hunger strikes and the camp-ins.
Well, what we've been doing, some of the teachers who are active in the union and some who just want to make sure we're being active during this, trying to save our jobs and our schools that we work at, put together some different actions. There's a group of teachers who have been doing a hunger strike. I believe today is the 8th day of the hunger strike. And then the teachers at our school started doing campouts. So we're kind of combining our efforts. So the hunger strikers are coming to our campus, and so are some other teachers from neighborhood schools. And we're out there camping and saying, this is our school, and we love our school so much that we're not going to leave our school.
Do you think you're really going to be able to make a difference?
Well, we hope so. I mean, it's gotten a lot of media attention, and the neighborhood is definitely noticing. We also have nightly potlucks for the community. Everybody brings something, and the teachers bring food, and we just sit around and talk, and there's entertainment. So we know that the community is definitely aware of what's going on, and even after the potluck is over, they've, you know, families have been coming by and giving us coffee or asking us if we need anything. So we know that we've got the community active in all of this, and we also have, you know, I think raised awareness because we have been getting media attention, and what we want to do is try to put pressure on the school district and Ramon Cortina's the superintendent, because there are things that they can do to change the situation, and we can make negotiations between the union and the district, and so far the superintendent has been, you know, he considers this a closed case, and he's ready to move on to next year and says that these terminations that he's issued will be going forward, and now he's looking to make more cuts next year. But we're hoping that he's going to engage in dialogue with the union and we can come to some kind of agreement, because the union is willing to compromise and talk about this. But right now, the superintendent is not willing to compromise. He's willing to move on to next year.
Okay, we asked Mr. Cortinas to be on our program today. He was unavailable. I don't think it was that he didn't want to come on, but we'll have him on future programs and ask him about some of these questions. Again, Julie Van Winkle is a 7th grade math and science teacher, at least for the moment, at the John Lathy Middle School at the Pico, in the Pico Union area. One of the things that Cortinas has said he is doing is passing the decision-making down to the local level as budget cuts are made, giving parents and teachers an opportunity to participate in how the cuts are going to be administered. Bill Ring is director of Transparent. That's a parent advocacy and leadership development organization. You can find it at transparent.org. His daughter attends high school in the LA Unified School District. And Bill Ring, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks, Warren. It's transparentschools.org, by the way.
Got it. Tell us what you're doing and what sort of challenges you're up against now that you have to make some decisions.
Well, there are huge challenges, that's an understatement, of course, but the focus of what we're trying to do is to get parents to wake up, to understand that the conversations that have taken place for years regarding negotiations, collective bargaining, and the kinds of things that the John Lathy Middle School teacher was speaking about have included the unions, the teachers, the various employees, and the district itself. But the parents have never been at the bargaining table. Now, we don't get wages, we don't get benefits, we don't argue about working conditions, but our students are the ones, our children are the ones who either succeed or fail as a result of the quality or lack thereof of the decisions that are being made in these negotiations. So one of the things we're doing is trying to bring back the Sunshine Committee, which is an opportunity for all of the union representatives, the collective bargaining representatives, and the parents to sit at the table at the same time when these discussions are taking place. And had we done a better job of that over the last few years, I would venture to say that we wouldn't be necessarily in the position we're in now, because we would have seen and foreseen some of this. There wouldn't be a lot of this bumping from place to place. We wouldn't be dismissing the relationships that you heard the teacher talk about that they've worked so hard to build with their students, we would have been a little more thoughtful about how we did this. And that's one of the things that we're working on trying to do. We're not just doing it, by the way, at the local district level, Warren. The state education code has a lot to do with how all of this stuff plays out. And one of the things we're looking at doing is organizing to have an effect on the education code. I'm already a part of an effort to look at creating waivers to the education code to allow districts more flexibility. The other side of that coin is flexibility without accountability is a formula for chaos.
Now, speaking of accountability, once again, Superintendent Cortinas has said on this program and elsewhere that decisions now can be made at the local level as to whether to fire teachers or use stimulus money, federal stimulus money, to maintain their jobs. Are you, as parents, do you think, qualified at the moment, prepared to participate in those decisions?
You know, Warren, that's a really good conversation to have. There are certainly teachers and principals who are not qualified to have those conversations. The superintendent released a press release not long ago saying, we are pleased that schools tailored their staffing based on reviewing achievement data. And we know that those conversations are not taking place universally in our schools. It's very uneven in terms of the way that the district has approached educating and training not just parents, but teachers and administrators in how to actually approach shared decision-making so we can create true partnerships around budget and program decisions at the schools. A lot of those decisions traditionally were made centrally. Certain categorical funds were decided upon at local school sites. And now the district, with the advent of some of the stimulus money that we're getting the benefit of, is pushing significantly more of those decisions regarding that money and, frankly, the academic plan, something known as a single plan, which is supposed to be a community-wide conversation to take place around what are the needs of the kids and what resources do we have to meet those needs. And I'm telling you right now that we have very uneven leadership in the district. One of the huge challenges to this district is good, quality principal leadership and honest conversations. People are so afraid about the game of gotcha that they do not want to have candid conversations at school sites. They really don't, in many cases, don't want parents as partners, and frankly, that's their responsibility, the school's responsibility, to educate us so we can be viable partners here.
Bill Ring, again, director of Transparent. The blog is, again, transparentschools.org. His daughter is in high school in the LAUSD. Let's talk for a moment about the charter schools, which were designed to at least try to get rid of some of these problems and initially organized to have decision-making on a local level. Steve Barr is the founder and CEO of Green Dot Public Schools, operates charter schools in the L.A. Unified District. And Steve Barr, it's good to have you back on our program.
Good evening, Warren.
Are you undergoing the same kinds of cuts that other schools are in the LAUSD?
Yeah, we have cuts, but unlike a school district where the dollars all come in categoricals to a district and then they take their vigorish to pay off the, you know, in the LAUSD, we have to understand there's 100,000 employees that work at LAUSD and 40,000 of them are teachers. So there's 60,000 people that aren't teachers that need their cut. And so what we have direct funding, it comes in a block in a charter school. So the money goes right to a school site. When we have cuts, all of the decision-making on where the budgeting and cuts and, you know, that's all made at a school site with teacher and parent input. We are, despite everything that's going on, we have not laid off a teacher, you know, in this year. So we cut back on everything else. We get to the bone on everything. But, you know, pink slips don't come flying from some office building downtown. I mean, that just doesn't happen. I mean, so those are site-based decisions. And I'm not talking about site-based decisions on 50% of the money after the district takes their VIG. I'm talking about all the money to the school site where it belongs.
Well, now, don't some of the administrators downtown help to keep you in business? You can't eliminate the administrators altogether, can you?
No, I'm not talking about all of them, but you need 60,000. I mean, if you – listen, Warren, if you were spending $25,000 and you send your kid to Crossroads or Brentwood School and you found out that 60% of that $25,000 went to non-teaching positions, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. And so, you know, so it's perfect that you have a teacher at a site and a parent and myself as a parent on the show, because those are the two groups that are royally screwed in this system. the lack of decision making, the budgeting, the dollars don't follow the kids to the sites where they belong, which are schools. We feel out of it at decision making, and not just in poor areas. You know, in Silver Lake where I live, you know, the parents in my neighborhood raised almost $400,000 to subsidize some art programs and parent, you know, and some teachers at the school site, just to find out that, you know, five or six pink slips came flying down and they have no say in it. Now, what happens to those parents is they pack it in and give up on the public school system, like, you know, like so many people have, you know, and so it goes. So, I mean, you know, the problem is that, and here it's a problem, but there's a huge opportunity right now. We should look at this system and say, okay, not a lot of it's working. You know, we all believe in it. So let's not tinker around the edges and let's not point fingers at these cuts. We need to scrap this system and make it a lot more efficient. And I think the only reason why charter schools are relevant in this argument, despite the fact that we serve these beautiful families, it's great R&D of what a district could become. My friend A.J. Duffy always says, you know, yeah, well, you get block funding at a school site. I said, yeah, well, why don't I'll go up to Sacramento with you, and we should demand that. And all schools get dollars straight and cut out the middleman.
Okay, A.J. Duffy, of course, the head of the UTLA. You say the teachers don't have a voice in this, but certainly the UTLA does. And one of the problems is that Bill Ring, I think, just enumerated, and so did Julie Van Winkle. It has to do with the seniority system that leads to the bumping of teachers teachers with greater seniority move around and take the jobs of those with less if cuts have to be made. You at your charter schools, as I understand it, have a contract that allows you to actually reduce the salaries of teachers if you have to. Have you done that?
No, we haven't. Thank God we haven't. But we cut back on everything else. I mean, but, you know, it's like when my wife and I at home, when we have less money that comes in, we sit around the table and we make decisions. Somebody doesn't make it for us, you know. And but if your priority is teachers, which that is our priority, and class sizes and all that, and, you know, and that teacher-to-student ratio, which creates an environment where teachers can actually apply their trade, which is get to know every kid. If that's your priority, not, you know, all these grown-ups in suits downtown, then the decision-making gets a lot easier because you're right at the site, you own the budget, and the last thing you're going to cut is teachers.
Again, Steve Barr is founder and CEO of Green Dot Public Schools, operating charter schools. Again, we asked Superintendent Cortinas to be on the program today. He was unavailable. We'll have him back. We'll hope to get our other guests as well so he can respond to some of the things that we're hearing today. Rose Bustos is an outgoing student trustee for the Los Angeles Community College District. That area is being hit very hard as well. She is just about to graduate from East Los Angeles College, East LA College. Rose Bustos, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
What's the impact that you, as both a student and a trustee, can tell us about at the Community College District?
The biggest impact that students are feeling is the cancellation of summer school classes. Our students have really carefully laid out educational plans, and for a summer school class to be canceled, it can delay a transfer to a university in the fall, or it could delay their graduation up to a year. It's a huge impact for students.
So summer school, is that going to bother you?
I'm actually going to be on my way transferring, but I've heard from a lot of students who are in the situation where their transfer is conditional on them taking one last class that's now canceled. They're unsure if they're going to be able to transfer without that class.
So that just delays, then, their ability to get into the workforce or to transfer to another school.
Absolutely. And we're hopeful that it's not indicative of more things to come, because if we have more classes canceled in the fall and spring, this impacts students' ability to qualify for financial aid. They need a minimum of 12 units to keep their financial aid package, and if they can't get the classes, they may lose their financial aid altogether.
My understanding that you're now paying $20 a unit. There's been some talk in Sacramento about raising the fees to $60 a unit. What would be the impact of that?
It would be devastating for so many of our students. Our students come from all types of backgrounds, but a lot of them could never afford to have their tuition tripled. Some of our students are protected because they are qualified for a Board of Governors fee waiver, which helps them with their tuition costs, but the $60 a unit would put some of our students out of school.
Okay, Rose Bustos, again, outgoing student trustee for the Los Angeles Community College District. Let me go back to two of our other guests just quickly in the few moments we have remaining. Bill Ring, again, with Transparent, available again at transparentschools.org. Would you agree with Steve Barr that we ought to scrap the system we have now and redraw it?
You know, Steve and I agree about a lot, and we've been knocking our heads against the wall for so long. The district's already breaking up in one way. Warren, if you look at the fact that we have an increasing number of students attending charter schools, that the district's been playing with iDesign schools and pilot schools, we've got a variety of different things. The Belmont pilot schools. So I'm inclined to sit down and say it's time to have that conversation.
Okay. Let me go back to Julie Van Winkle again. You're a union member and an organizer of hunger strikes and campouts. You said that the union is now willing to negotiate, but the district isn't. Is this a system that's failing?
I definitely think that there are problems with the Los Angeles Unified School District for sure, but I also think, you know, you mentioned earlier that all these problems are caused by seniority. Well, in the system we have, you know, seniority is essential. You just talked earlier about, some principals who are unable to make decisions that are well thought out and carefully planned. And, you know, our union fought hard to get seniority.
But isn't it the seniority system that's causing the problems that you told us about, where teachers have to be bumped for other teachers?
Well, no, because the fact is, it's not that we have too many teachers. I have 36 13-year-olds in my class. We don't have too many teachers. You know, we have teachers and who need to work with smaller groups of kids. So if the district were willing to keep the class size, which is already ridiculously large, where it is instead of raising it, then we wouldn't have these problems with bumping. I mean, what we should do is look at how to make classrooms smaller.
Well, if, though, there's a huge financial crisis such as we have now, how is the district supposed to solve that if they don't reduce the number of personnel?
Well, there's a lot of waste that goes on in the district. We have seven mini districts within the district that all have district offices that are staffed with a lot of people. The district owns the TV station. There are also, you know, as people discussed earlier, a lot of administrative out of classroom positions. And, you know, these are positions that I personally don't think are as important as the ones who work directly with the kids. And corralling the kids in larger classes is not an effective way to solve this problem.
Thanks again to all of you for talking to us tonight about a school system that seems stretched to the breaking point and beyond. Julie Van Winkle at the John Lathey Middle School in the Pico Union area, Bill Ring with Transparent and transparentschool.org, Steve Barr, the founder and CEO of Green Dot Public Schools, and Rose Bustos, the outgoing student trustee at the Los Angeles Community College District. I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. When the basketball finals finally begin tomorrow night at the Staples Center, fans won't see a confrontation between Kobe Bryant and LeBron James. Instead of the Cleveland Cavaliers, the Lakers will face the Orlando Magic and their budding superstar, Dwight Howard. Jill Painter is a sports columnist for the Daily News. And Jill, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Well, thank you.
Phil Jackson says that this guy, Howard, is a real, real powerhouse inside. He says, I don't know who can guard him.
Well, that's true. They don't call him Superman for nothing. I think we'll find that proves to be a very good matchup. They'll have to put the young Andrew Bynum on him for a little while, and Bynum has had a lot of foul trouble. But they've got a couple other guys they can throw at him, too. I think you just have to understand that Dwight Howard is going to get his baskets, he's going to get his points, and they're just going to have to hope that all those good shooters for the Magic aren't going to be knocking down open shots while they're trying to contain Howard.
Phil Jackson says Andrew Bynum is only effective for 4 or 5 minutes at a time before he needs to come out. He's been injured, had a hard time in his career. So who's going to be able to be available then to take on Dwight Howard?
Well, they're going to have to share those duties. Lamar Odom might have to share some of those. Pau Gasol might have to share some of those. Of course, Pau will probably have other guarding duties as well. But you bring up a good question. We're not really sure, but I think it's going to be by committee. Bynum is still, he's been in the league only 4 years. He's only 21. I think some people believe that he should be a lot further along than he is right now. But he will be required to, pretty much his only job will be to defend Dwight Howard.
I love your phrase, basketball defense by committee. That's how the Lakers, I guess, may have to get it done. How is it that the Magic were able to take out the Cavaliers and reduce LeBron James to not being terribly effective in the final game?
Well, LeBron James didn't have quite a very good supporting cast. It's certainly different than, like, with the Lakers and Kobe Bryant. He's got Pau Gasol and Lamar Odom, to name just a couple of guys, and those are two very, very good players. Trevor Ariza has been amazing in the playoffs. But LeBron doesn't have that sort of cast with Cleveland. And if you look at that team and take LeBron James out of the picture, you wonder, I mean, I don't even think that team would make the playoffs. So he doesn't have enough help. And the other thing is Orlando is a very, very good team. They have a lot of good shooters. They make a lot of three-point shots. Dwight Howard inside. And so I think that the thing about Orlando is they play in a small market. I didn't even know that much about them midway through the year and how good they were, just because they don't get a lot of publicity. But I think Dwight Howard will be able to make a name for himself if he has a good series on this national stage.
When the Lakers played the Magic during the season, who won?
Orlando. So they played a couple of games, and Orlando won both of them. So they're different teams. Jameer Nelson was playing point guard for Orlando then, and he's been out, I believe it was shoulder surgery, for about the last 35 games. And that's another thing. He has been practicing, and he might play in the finals. But it seems like the Lakers and Magic are a little bit of different teams. And then, of course, you can't always take too much from the regular season. It's going to be very hard for Orlando to win games at Staples Center. I think the Lakers are so good there. And with the Lakers having home court advantage, the games 1 and 2 here in L.A., and if necessary, games 6 and 7, it's going to be tough for them to win in L.A.
Without the matchup so much anticipated between Kobe Bryant and LeBron James, do you think there's going to be the kind of audience that the NBA had hoped for?
Certainly not what they had hoped. I mean, that would have just been a ratings bonanza if the Lakers and Cleveland were both in the finals. I mean, you have the game's two biggest megastars, LeBron and Kobe, that you would have had. I mean, that might have been the highest-rated NBA Finals ever. Of course, we've had some, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson Finals as well, but I'm sure the NBA is disappointed. And then you have to look at all these companies like Nike and Vitamin Water who have launched these huge campaigns on this whole great debate of who's better, Kobe versus LeBron. So I'm sure those companies are a little bit bummed. But Nike has doing a story that's running in tomorrow's paper, and Nike is still going to be running those LeBron James, Kobe Bryant ads all the way through the NBA Finals because they believe, and I do too, that this debate over who's the best player in the league is not going to stop just because Cleveland didn't make the finals.
What about Dwight Howard?
You want to put him into the conversation too, right?
Well, sure, why not?
You might as well. I don't think Dwight Howard, I mean, Dwight Howard has had an amazing year. He's averaged a double-double and I think 20 points and 13 rebounds a game. He's had a monster season. But I think we would have to see that over time. LeBron has played very well the last few years and won his first MVP this year. Kobe Bryant, MVP last year, and has had, I mean, he's 30 now. He's been in the league for, I think, 12 years, 13 years.
An old man.
We've seen him play very well consistently over time. I think Dwight Howard is young, and he's going to have to, I think, prove that he can consistently play like this year in and year out.
Right.
And then I think you're right. We could include him in that conversation.
All right. We will see if there is a superstar in the making and if the Lakers can hang in and use home court advantage or whatever else they've got to defeat the Orlando Magic. Starts tomorrow night. Jill Painter, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Los Angeles Daily News sports columnist, Which Way LA, produced tonight by Gary Scott, Andrea Brody, and Christian Bordahl. Our managing producers, Karen Radziner, technical director, Mike Newport. You can email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/whichwayLA. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.